God, we take this seriously. This is your holy word. This was your decision on what to speak to us as your people. Everything that is in this book, it is not there by coincidence or oversight. You said exactly what you wanted to say to us through the pages of this book. We are grateful to have it. Every word that you have spoken, Lord, it is what we live for. It is our daily bread. It is life and it is health. So we ask as we open the scriptures tonight as a congregation that your spirit would join along with us, guiding us and directing us, taking charge over every word, and minister to the congregation individually as you so desire. We want you, Lord, to do what you want in this place through the word. In the name of Jesus, amen. Numbers chapter 6. It's a short chapter, especially for the Old Testament. It's only 22 verses long. Next week, different story. Numbers chapter 7. A very long verse. I think it may be the second longest in the Bible next to what would be the longest chapter in the Bible. Psalm 119. I think you all knew that. You're just tired and didn't want to shout it out, I guess. So a very short chapter for us, and it is the only instruction given in all of the Bible to explain the ins and the outs of the Nazirite vow. Nazirite comes from the Hebrew word natsir, and it means to set apart or to sanctify. And let's just clear this up right from the start. Jesus was not a Nazirite. He was not a Nazirite. He was a Nazarene. There's a difference between Nazirite and Nazareth. Nazareth is from the Hebrew word netzer. I got to get this pronunciation correct because they are so close. Hebrew word netzer, which means a branch. So look how close those two words are. Natzir and netzer. Very close, all right, but they're totally different things. Nazareth is a location. It is the name of a town. Jesus was a Nazarene, which means he was from Nazareth. And even though those are very similar words, just keep those in mind that we don't mix the two up. A Nazirite vow was a completely volitional or voluntary vow that a person could take. No one ever had to do this if they didn't want to. It was merely a suggestion from God to individuals that wanted to do something special to bless him. It's for those who wanted to take things up a notch in their walks with the Lord. And God gets to say here, here's a gift suggestion. You want to bless me? Here's a gift suggestion. Here's something that you can do to bless my heart. And here are the laws, the guidelines, on exactly how to do that. Now, that might seem strange that God would say that. You want to do something nice for me? Okay, here's what you do. But it is completely appropriate that the Lord does that because who could possibly do better at gift suggestions than the person that you're getting the gift for? We acknowledge this all year through. When it comes to birthdays and holidays, when someone has a birthday or a holiday, what do? Usually, if we care at all about blessing them with what we get them, we usually go to them and we say, hey, can you get me a gift list? Can you get me a wish list so that I know that what I'm buying you, you actually are going to like and be able to use? If you don't go to that person directly and ask for a wish list, which I do this every year with the kids, get me a wish list for your birthdays, for Christmas. If you don't, here's what's going to happen. Anything you would have put on that list, you're probably not going to get. You're going to get what I think you want or need, and there's a good chance you aren't going to like it at all, and it's just going to take up space and collect dust. But the other thing we do is we go to people that are closer. When it's someone we're, you know, not super close with, we go to people that are closer to them. You know, Debbie, I want to give Barry something for his birthday. Well, this is a hypothetical, so that aside, I go to her and I say, what can I get him? Otherwise, it's going to be too much of a risk that what I'm going to do is I'm going to impose my own desires on that person's gift when I get that for them. I'm going to be thinking about the things that I like and the things that I would enjoy if someone were to get me a gift. And so we go to them and we say, you know, here you go. I picked this out for you. I had no idea what you liked, but I got you this. I hope you like it. It's something I would really like. And they say, well, you can keep it then because I got nothing to do with it, or I already got three of them or whatever. That's the danger we run when we don't know someone well and we don't have a wish list from them. The Nazarite vow eliminates all of that from being a possibility. It kept them from bringing stuff to the Lord or doing things for the Lord that he had no interest in. There's definitely something to be said for creative worship, where we kind of work outside the box and we do things to bless the Lord's heart. I always, when I bring that topic up, reference Abraham for his creative worship. You know the story. We covered it in Genesis. As a measure of creative worship, Abraham plants a tree and he says, Lord, that's yours. I'm dedicating that tree to you. That's very creative worship. You don't find that as guidelines in the scriptures on how to bring tree offerings to the Lord. No, that's very creative. That's outside the book and outside the box. And the Lord loves that kind of stuff to a great degree. But there is even greater confidence in already knowing in advance how to bless God's heart. He's told us how to do it, at least, you know, for the Old Testament saints. And we're going to pull principles from this, so really it applies to us as well. For Old Testament individuals, this was one of those ways. So we want to look at the ins and outs of the Nazarite vow down to verse 21, and then the last six verses, verses 22 through 27, we'll look at God's instruction for the priestly blessing, and we'll finish on that high note of how the priests were to daily pray over the people of Israel. Verse 1, let's begin reading. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, verse 2, speak to the people of Israel and say to them, when either a man or a woman makes a special vow, the vow of a Nazarite, to separate himself to the Lord, and I know that's mid-sentence, but let's hang up and hold up there for just a moment to emphasize the fact that anyone could bless the Lord by taking advantage of a vow, a Nazarite vow before him. You didn't have to be a descendant of Aaron, a priest. You didn't even have to be a Levite, a guy that could work with the physical aspect of the temple. And great news for you ladies, you didn't even have to be of the male gender in order to do this. All were welcome to participate. The Lord will use male pronouns from here on out as he's giving these laws, but now you already know based on verse 2, this vow has no gender lines, no boundaries. This was open and available for every person within the nation of Israel. And you will notice as you study through this, there is no time period given for a Nazarite vow in the Bible. You won't find it in this chapter. The Mishnah, if you know what that is, a collection of Jewish writings, the Mishnah tells us that these were predefined periods of time, and they had to be of 30-day chunks at a time. So according to the Mishnah, if you wanted to voluntarily fulfill a Nazarite vow, it could be 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, or any combination of adding months. Now, we do not know that for sure. That is taking the word of ancient Jewish writings. But here's what we do know. We do know that at least to a great degree, the time period that a person would serve one of these Nazarite vows, it was all determined at the individual level. However long you felt inspired to be working on fulfilling this vow, whether that was 1 month or 2 months or a year or 2 years or even a lifetime. You could do that as well. But whatever time period you desired, you set that time period in advance. You couldn't like cheat and say, I'm wanting to do a year, but I'm going to start with a month and see how it goes. No, you made a decision and it was a predetermined set of time, and whatever time period you set for this vow, you did that in advance, and then you needed to really commit to it and carry it out. Because otherwise, what you're wanting to do really backfires on you. You're wanting to make a statement to the Lord about your love and devotion to Him. And, you know, if you set your sight on 3 months and you get a month into it, that leaves a very bad statement for the Lord. It would be, Lord, I love you so much. I'm gonna take this Nazirite vow for 3 months. Oops, Lord, I could only do a month. Turns out I thought I loved you 3 months worth. In actuality, I love you about 1 month's worth, Lord. That's as far as I could get before I started to turn back and seek my own pleasures. Notice the purpose of this vow. The word Nazirite implies that it was all about separation. Remember, the word Nazirite means to be separate or to be set apart. So it's when a person decided, I already love the Lord. I already obey Him in a general sense. I keep His laws. I seek to bless His heart. But it's just not enough. I want to go even bigger for Him, and I want to go even further with Him. And we here at Anchored Fellowship recognize that as a timeless spiritual principle. Not all churches do that. Some churches, once they get you saved, once they get your profession of faith, that's all they want. That's all they care about. And then they'll spend the rest of your time telling you about what has been afforded to you because you're saved. Here at Anchored Fellowship, we want to get people saved, but we never stop there. We also want to continue to convince the saved people to go bigger for God and further with God. That is the way of the Word. That is what the Scripture teaches us by principle. So as if Numbers chapter 6 isn't far enough back in the Old Testament, it begins, if nothing else, right there, Numbers chapter 6, just on the other side of that second year in the history of the nation. And God is already revealing to the nation, look, you don't have to just be content to be my people and then sit on your hands and do nothing with that. You can press in further. You can dig in deeper. You can love me more. You can devote yourself to me further. And there are ways that you can do this. This would be a rich opportunity for the whole nation of Israel, because, you know, there was that whole thing that if you weren't born into the right family, if you weren't born a male, then you just could not serve the Lord at the tabernacle level. And I'm sure that probably hurt some people. And I would think that many would say to themselves, Lord, I'm not a priest. Priests are working right there, very near you, in your presence. Levites get to get at least somewhat closer than I do. But Lord, is there something that I can do as a congregant from one of the other tribes, not the tribe of Aaron, the priestly tribe, or the tribe of Levi, the ministry tabernacle tribe? Lord, I'm from another tribe. Is there something that I can do as sort of an alternative to what they have, that nearness to you? Is there something that I can do to get that nearness with you? And the answer, according to Numbers chapter 6, as well as the offerings that we read about in Leviticus, would be yes. There are things that you can do voluntarily to express your devotion to me and to build intimacy between us. The Nazirite vow of Numbers chapter 6, along with those voluntary offerings of Leviticus, were great ways for them to develop that intimacy with God. Because what we find out is that God opened up these opportunities to the laymen of the congregation. So, you know, these laymen that couldn't have these positions near God, they could have hearts that were near God, and that is by far the better thing, because the position near God did not guarantee that the heart of that person would be near God. The history of Israel is replete with priests that were near God in their work, but they were not near God in their hearts. Service for God and intimacy with God are not the same thing, and they don't always coexist as you would expect them to, and as they should. So you might word it like this. Service for God wasn't available to all, but intimacy with God was. And again, that's the better of the two. So what follows here are the requirements on how to biblically further separate yourself to the Lord. Verse 3, he shall separate himself from wine and strong drink. So no fermented, or as we would say, alcoholic beverages at all while serving out a predefined period of a Nazirite vow. Reading on, he shall drink no vinegar made from wine or strong drink, and shall not drink any juice of grapes or eat grapes fresh or dried, so no alcohol, and no grapes, and no raisins. Verse 4, all the days of his separation he shall eat nothing that is produced by the grapevine, not even the seeds or the skins. I'm not sure why anyone would want to eat the seeds or the skins, but just in case you got that itch during a Nazirite vow, the Lord says, no, don't do it. Now, back on May 4th of 2022, last year, I did a study called Alcohol and the Christian. It was basically a refutation of the belief that it is always a sin for a Christian to drink alcohol. Biblically, that is just not true. Regardless of what we feel about alcohol and its effects, biblically, that is just not true. We know that the Bible does teach that it is an act of sin to get drunk, and it is a state of sinful living to be an alcoholic or a drunkard. But according to the Bible, it is not a sin to drink alcohol moderately and in a controlled way. If you did not catch that study, I recommend you look it up and listen to it later. Again, it's called Alcohol in the Christian, and it is from May 4th of 2022. Verse 3 and verse 20 should be all that a Christian needs to read in order to correct that misconception and misunderstanding about what the Bible teaches. Because verse 3 tells us that during the temporary Nazirite vow, the individual is to abstain from wine and strong drink. Then hop down to verse 20 in advance. Verse 20 says that when the Nazirite vow is completed, that person may resume drinking wine and strong drink. So, boom, there you have it. Were the Old Testament saints allowed to drink wine and strong drink? The answer, irrefutably, yes. Undeniably, yes. Now, I know the stubborn die hard. So, reading that passage should do it, but won't do it for everyone. They're still going to try to come up with all sorts of attempts to try to make the Bible say what they want it to say. And so they'll say things like, well, that's the Old Testament, though. And we live in the New Testament. So if that's the argument to that, then I just want to say, are you really honestly paying attention to what you just said? Are you trying to tell me that the Lord was more lenient with his laws on just this one point, that he was on this one point more lenient with the Old Testament saint that was living under the law than he is with the New Testament saint that is living under the covenant grace, the covenant of grace? Does that even sound right to you? And of course, the answer should be no, because that doesn't make sense. The Lord is not easier on the Old Testament Jew that is under the law than he is on the New Testament Christian that is living under grace. people that make those kind of arguments really just need to study their Bible. As I said to you in that study, if you're looking for good reasons to abstain from alcohol and to teach others to abstain from alcohol, there are all sorts of good reasons. All sorts of good reasons. The destructiveness of it, the statistics of how harmful it can be alone. There are many good reasons to abstain from it and to teach others to abstain from it, but we need to be mature and understand that the Bible is not one of them. The Bible teaches, whether we like it or not, the opposite, that fermented wine, when it is not being abused, it is one of the few very symbols that God consistently uses to symbolize his blessing over his people. And if you read the scriptures, you'll find out that wine, when it is not being abused, is a symbol of pleasure. David himself, Psalm 104, verse 15, said, "The Lord gives wine to gladden the heart of man." So, verses 3 and 4, a Nazarite vow was to be a deprivation of a pleasure or a blessing. We would call this today in America a guilty pleasure. This is the Lord saying, abstain from or deprive yourself of this pleasure of drinking wine, strong drink, or eating grapes or raisins or anything associated with the vine. Now, if you're wondering why the Lord picked those, all you have to do is mind your place. Figure out where you are in history as opposed to where they were in history. For any nation in existence at this time, you really couldn't do any better than grapes and wine when it came to pleasure food and pleasure drink. They didn't have the unlimited snack options that we do today. Man, I can't imagine if the Lord had to make a list for today, you know? Now, you're going to want to abstain from Doritos and nachos that aren't Doritos and ice cream, and the list would be huge. And I know if the Lord were designing this law today specifically for me, it would be, Arlen, if you're going to do a Nazarite vow, avoid these two things, chocolate and coffee. Those are my guilty pleasures. Those are my associations with blessing. When I'm sitting down with some chocolate and some coffee, I'm feeling mighty blessed. And I'm thanking the Lord for everything that I have. So that's where we are in connection with them as we compare ourselves to them. According to the Lord, this is a way of for a predefined period of time, making this statement that, Lord, for a short while, for this temporary period, I want to take those blessings that you gave me, those pleasure foods, And maybe even guilty pleasures, and I want to put them aside for a while. And though you gave them to me, and though you're blessed by them and all that, Lord, I want to put them aside for a while so that I'm not focused on those blessings, but on the giver of those blessings. That's what this time period was all about. And according to the Lord, that's something that really catches him in the feels. That's something that really blesses him. It sends a strong message to the Lord. Wow, I know how much wine and grapes meant to the Jews. I know how much chocolate and coffee means to Arlen. Man, if they would sacrifice that for me. That's a strong statement. And that indeed is what it's all about. Verse 5. All the days of his vow of separation, no razor shall touch his head until the time is completed for which he separates himself to the Lord. He shall be holy. He shall let the locks of hair of his head grow long. Stop right there. Okay, why would the Lord want them to look like a bunch of hippies while they're doing this whole Nazarite vow thing? Is that what blesses the Lord, the hippie look? I hope not. I don't think so. I don't think that's it. I think God here chose to make this the visible sign that someone was serving out one of these time periods of a Nazarite vow. they would stand out from everyone else very definitely. The men would start looking all shaggy, like No Shave November, you know, men start looking all shaggy. The women would start fighting with dead ends, and it would just be a serious mess. You would notice it on people. You would see it. People would be able to tell. The worse your hair, the longer your vow. Wow, this guy's been serving out a Nazarite vow for a very long time. His hair's a mess. I don't know if you guys think about this kind of stuff, but I think about this kind of weird stuff all the time. Like, this would be especially painful for the person with a receding hairline. You end up with a skullet. I mean, this would definitely be something that you would notice. So here's what's happening here. God wanted others to know that you were extremely dedicated to him. He did not want this to be a secret, that you were fulfilling a Nazarite vow. Jesus did teach us in Matthew chapter 6 that when it comes to our spiritual works, things like prayer and fasting and giving alms to the poor, that we should never do those things to be seen by men. But what the Lord meant by that is that we should never do things to be seen by others solely for the purpose of impressing them. That is self-pride over our spiritual accomplishments. That's what that is. And there is a very fine line there when it comes to being seen for the works that we're doing for the Lord. And it's one that we have to be very careful with. God does not want you broadcasting how great you think you're doing for him. I'm reminded of the words of Nehemiah from the Old Testament. When they were trying to distract him from the work, he said, "I can't come down. I'm too busy." These are his words. And I quote, he said, "I am doing a great work." And I want to remind you, he didn't say, "I'm doing a great job at the work." He didn't say that. I'm doing such a good job, I can't stop now. Oh man, I'm knocking this out of the park. No, not "I'm doing a great job at the work," but Nehemiah said, "I'm doing a great work." And if you got that line down when it comes to all of your charitable deeds, your alms, your praying, your fasting, your Bible study, when you are seen doing those things, or when you talk to others about you doing those things, if you're doing that for the purpose of bringing God glory and not you, then you're on the right side of that fine line. God does not want you doing good works for the sake of glorifying yourself. You need to be doing it all to bring him glory. Jesus said in Matthew chapter 5, verse 16, just a chapter before he taught us about doing those alms and praying and fasting in secret. In that verse, he said, "Let your light shine before others so that they may see your good works and glorify not you or your church that you came from, but your Father who is in heaven." So, verses 3 and 4, a Nazarite vow was to be a deprivation of a pleasure. And verse 5, a Nazarite vow was to be a demonstration of deep devotion. Verse 6, all the days that he separates himself to the Lord, he shall not go near a dead body. Verse 7, not even for his father or for his mother or brother or sister, if they die, shall he make himself unclean. Because his separation to God is on his head. He's wearing this vow through uncut hair for all to see. In other words, people know you're doing this. People know you're taking a Nazarite vow. So make sure you're not touching a dead body regardless of whose it is. Verse 8, all the days of his separation, he is holy to the Lord. This would be very tough for someone to lose a loved one during a Nazarite vow. You wouldn't get there. You wouldn't be able to hold their hand as they take their final breaths. You wouldn't be able to get that one last hug in after they had passed away. You wouldn't even be able to help the family embalm that loved one, which of course was an important part and a common thing for them to do back then. You made a vow to the Lord, and you had to keep that come what may. When you said, "Lord, I'm going to do this The Lord said, okay, you're on record and I'm paying attention. The Lord is very serious about that sort of thing. I know I quote Ecclesiastes 5 verse 5 a lot, but I just want you guys to make sure of it. You know, years ago there was that movement sweeping through Christian circles. It was called Promise Keepers. And on the surface, it was a great movement, but really, everything that that movement was trying to do is get people to make more promises to God. And then that gets you on the hook, and then you want to carry out those promises because of the guilt that you'd experience if you fail. Well, the more promises you make to the Lord, the more opportunities you create for failure. So I really like the words of Solomon there in Ecclesiastes 5, verse 5. He says, it is better that you should not vow than that you should vow and not pay. You really have to stop and think before you make a commitment to the Lord. Any kind of commitment. It doesn't have to be an official vow like this. I always discourage people from, in their confessions, praying the wrong way. Confession should never be, Lord, I sinned, and I promise you I'm never going to do it again. That is foolish, because the next time you do that sin, if you do, well, now you've done the sin and you've broken a vow that you made to the Lord. Lord, I just know I'm not going to get wrapped up in this again. It's foolish to make vows to the Lord that you aren't 150 or 1,500% sure that you're going to keep. Verses 6 through 8 are obviously dealing with physical uncleanness. That's undeniable. But of course, as everything is in the Old Testament, this is to be taken very highly symbolically. I'm not sure if that's good English, but that's what I need to say. And the symbolism would be depicting cleanliness of any sort across the board. Most importantly, the symbolism would be the depiction of spiritual cleanliness. That's what the Lord is most concerned about. That's what He is symbolizing in the prohibition of touching the dead bodies. So verses 3 and 4, a Nazarite vow was to be, number 1, a deprivation of a pleasure. Verse 5, number 2, it was to be a demonstration of deep devotion. And number 3, verses 6 through 8, it was to also be a dedication of cleanliness, or as we would say, holiness. That is the Nazarite vow in a nutshell. And if you have that much written down in your notes later on, you're good to go. Verse 9, and if any man dies very suddenly beside him, and he defiles his consecrated head, then he shall shave his head on the day of his cleansing. On the seventh day, he shall shave it. So, if they became defiled by a dead body, they were to shave their head that day, and then they were to shave their head once again 7 days later. What's the purpose for that? Well, the first one we get, that's the message of immediately cutting away the defilement. And it's the next part that we kind of scratch our heads on. Lord, what's this all about? What is the symbolism behind waiting 7 days and then shaving the head again? Well, that would be the symbolism of, again, cutting away any defilement that may show up as a residual effect of that initial defilement 7 days prior. A modern comparison would be, it's like saying, Lord, I'm sorry that I watched that or heard that. I'm sorry that I experienced that. Forgive me for that. And not just that, but any residual effects that might eventually come through this heart of mine because of what I heard, because of that defilement, because of what I saw. So it's a way of saying, Lord, I want to make sure that I am just entirely cleaned up before you. I want all residue of that defilement washed away and cleansed by you. Verse 10, on the eighth day, he shall bring 2 turtle doves or 2 pigeons to the priest, to the entrance of the tent of meeting, and the priest shall offer one for a sin offering and the other for a burnt offering and make atonement for him because he sinned by reason of the dead body. And he shall consecrate his head the same day, verse 12, and separate himself to the Lord for the days of his separation and bring a male lamb a year old for a guilt offering, but the previous period shall be void because his separation was defiled. Simply put, if you break the vow, you start over. You don't get to resume after you're pronounced clean. You don't get to pick right back up where you left off. You have to start over completely. And as verses 9 through 12 declare, it does not matter if that defilement was intentional or accidental. Doesn't matter. Verses 9 through 12, here's the meaning. Sin is sin, whether you meant it or not. Now, verses 9 through 12 tell us all about what sacrifices were needed in order to make this right and to cleanse this defilement. But we aren't going to spend any time on that tonight. We aren't going to get into those sacrificial specifics. We've covered that in great detail in the book of Leviticus. So do yourself a favor. If as we are reading through this, you're reading about these sacrifices and you can't remember what they're all about, can't remember what they mean or what they're for, do yourself the favor. I know it's a lot of work, but do yourself the favor and listen back through our Leviticus studies. For this study, what we're going to do is we're going to focus on just the major lessons, okay? Verses 9 through 12, major lesson, even unintentional sin is sin. They needed to get that through their hearts and their heads, and so do we. It hasn't changed in the New Testament. Sin is sin even when you didn't mean it. And that is important because if you don't understand that, it leads to us trying to absolve our own sins before God, or if nothing else, try to lessen the impact and try to make the Lord somehow feel better about the severity of our sin. Lord, yes, I did that, but I didn't mean it. It was completely accidental. I would never intentionally commit that sin. You know what that is? That kind of statement, that kind of thinking. It's confession gone wrong. It's a terrible way to confess sin. This is another free lesson tonight on confession. You know what the Lord wants? He wants the first part of that confession. Lord, I did wrong. Lord, I committed a sin. You know what the Lord doesn't want? The rest of it. He doesn't want to hear why. He doesn't want the excuse or the explanation. I assure you, God is never going to hear you confess and do one of those, I'm sorry, but, you know, Lord, I did sin, but it was an accident, or I got pressured into this, or it was caused because of extenuating circumstances. The Lord is never going to hear that kind of confession and then go, wow, that makes sense. I feel totally better about your sin now. Thank you so much for enlightening me. I didn't realize you had a good reason to sin. I assure you, the Bible teaches, intentional or unintentional, there's never a good reason to sin. There's never an acceptable excuse to explain away sinful behavior. We just have to admit it, that because we're sinners, we're going to sin intentionally at times. But because we are sinners by nature, we are also going to sin even when we're not trying. That's how good we are at sin. Even when we're not trying, even when we're unaware of it, when it's totally accidental or incidental, we're going to sin. So the Lord just wants this. I did it. Lord, you're right about this being a sin. You know the word confession is from the Greek word homologeo. I think I taught you that before. Homologeo simply means literally the same speech. That's what confession means, literally the same speech. Confession is when you're on the same page with God over what is sin and what isn't. So confession is this: Lord, you're right about this sin. It is a sin, and I did it. That's what confession is when done properly. So just get in the habit, church, of leaving all of your excuses out of your confession. You're not going to make the Lord feel better about it. It's not really going to work to relieve you of the excess guilt over it. Just leave the excuses and the reasoning out of your confession and tell the Lord the good, the bad, and the ugly. Verse 13. And this is the law for the Nazarite. When the time of his separation has been completed, however long you've vowed, you've completed all the days of that Nazarite vow now, reading on, he shall be brought to the entrance of the tent of meeting, verse 14, and he shall bring his gift to the Lord, one male lamb, a year old, without blemish, for a burnt offering. Listen to all of this. This is crazy. And one ewe lamb, a year old, without blemish, as a sin offering, and one ram without blemish as a peace offering, and a basket of unleavened bread, loaves of fine flour mixed with oil, and unleavened wafers smeared with oil, and their grain offering, and their drink offerings, verse 16. And the priest shall bring them before the Lord and offer his sin offering and his burnt offering. And he shall offer the ram as a sacrifice of peace offering to the Lord with the basket of unleavened bread. The priest shall offer also its grain offering and its drink offering. Can you believe all of that? Can you believe the extensive and very expensive list of offerings that God demanded for someone who sinned against their Nazarite vow and broke that vow because of defilement? It's just a powerful statement by the Lord about how seriously the Lord takes this vow. Verse 18, and the Nazarite shall shave his consecrated head at the entrance of the tent of meeting, and shall take from the hair, from his consecrated head and put it on the fire that is under the sacrifice of the peace offering. And the priest shall take the shoulder of the ram when it is boiled, and one unleavened loaf out of the basket, and one unleavened wafer, and shall put them on the hands of the Nazarite after he has shaved the hair of his consecration. Verse 20, and the priest shall wave them for a wave offering before the Lord. They are a holy portion for the priest, together with the breast that is waved and the thigh that is contributed. And after that, the Nazarite may drink wine. Verse 21, this is the law of the Nazarite. But if he vows an offering to the Lord above his Nazarite vow, so if that wasn't enough offering to bring, and you wanted to do more, the Lord says, knock yourself out. Go for it. You're allowed to exceed the minimum standards here. If you want to bring a couple rams, if you want to bring a couple extra wafers, just go for it. Reading on, as he can afford, in exact accordance with the vow that he takes, then he shall do in addition to the law of the Nazarite. Verses 18 through 21 are just a good reminder that even the voluntary Nazarite vow was not possible without sacrifice. It is sacrifice that produces and provides for every opportunity that we have to bless the Lord and to be near with God. And without blood sacrifice, you're going nowhere with the Lord. It takes blood sacrifice to draw you close to him. So I echo the sentiment of the Apostle Paul in 2 Corinthians 9:15 when he says, thanks be to God for his inexpressible gift. Lord, you made all of this possible in the Old Testament through the blood of animals, in the New Testament through the blood of his dear son Christ. What a blessing that we have. Now, there are two popular Bible characters, one in the Old Testament and one in the New Testament, who were selected by God from their mother's womb to live a life that was under a Nazarite vow. So from their womb, the Lord informed the parents of those two children, hey, from the day that they are born, they are to observe this Nazarite vow. The Old Testament one was Samson, and the New Testament one was John the Baptist, right? Both Samson and John the Baptist lived their entire life observing these three laws in order to serve a lifetime as a Nazarite. The Apostle Paul also made a Nazarite vow It was for a temporary period of time. You can read about that in Acts chapter 18, verse 18. But Samson stands out the most. By the way, if you're wondering, we never read anywhere that Jesus took either a temporary or lifelong Nazarite vow. And I'm 100% that he did not. At least not a permanent lifelong Nazarite vow. And there are reasons for that. And you can look at those reasons if you want in that message, alcohol and the Christian. But Samson stands out the most because he played it pretty fast and loose with this whole Nazarite vow thing. He didn't really seem to have much of a heart for God or concern for his Nazarite vow. And the final straw was when Samson confessed to Delilah that his power was in the length of his hair. And that was a mess. You know, Samson really had a problem with Philistine women. He just could not stay away from Philistine women. And he ends up with Delilah, a Philistine, and the Philistines convince her, hey, get the secret out of him. This guy is killing us by the thousands. One guy killing us Philistines by the thousands. You have got to get to the bottom of this. You have got to crack the code. You've got to find out what Samson's secret is. And so Delilah pressed him and pressed him. You know how women do. Oh, you don't love me. If you loved me, you'd tell me. For my records, I just want to know. There's nothing at all shady going on. Just for my records, I want to know. And if you really love me, you tell me. And she kept on him, and the scripture says he just becomes vexed over it. He gets tired of that struggle with her, and he eventually tells her what he thinks is the source of his strength. And he says it's his hair. He tells Delilah, if you cut my hair, I'll be as weak as any other man. I won't be strong like I am now. So Samson believed that his power, his supernatural power, was in the length of his hair. And that just kind of shows you that Samson really did not have a grip on this whole Nazarite vow thing. Not at all. It's pretty obvious the power wasn't in the length of his hair. It wasn't anything outward. It didn't have anything to do with those three laws on being a Nazarite. It was all about the internals of the vow, not the externals of the vow. It was the heart behind it that the Lord was really trying to pull out through those three externals. And like I said, that was the final straw, and that brings us to one of the saddest verses in all of the Bible, Judges chapter 16, verse 20, where it says, but he, Samson, did not know that the Lord had left him. So, very important truth for us that if you don't take the Lord seriously, why would you expect him to take you seriously? You're going to be filled with faults and failures, no doubt. We all are. But there's one thing you can do, and that is just take the Lord seriously. Know where his heart is. Know how to bless him. Know what sin is. Know how to obey. Do your best with all of that. And above all, regardless of how often you fail, above all, take the Lord seriously. So, we have the whole recipe here for the Nazarite vow, verses 3 and 4, a deprivation of a pleasure, verse 5, a demonstration of deep devotion, verses 6 through 8, a dedication to cleanliness or holiness. And we'll close out with this for those of you looking to step things up in your intimacy with the Lord. Maybe you're thinking, I'd like to do something like this, maybe some kind of New Testament twist on a Nazarite vow. I want to come alongside of you and say that's not a crazy idea. It's a very good thing. And Christians do this sort of thing all the time. All you really have to do is pluck out those three principles that I've recited to you like four or five times now. And then once you pluck out those three principles, it's really easy to see how you can relate them into New Testament application. And it's going to just probably sprout all kinds of ideas for you on how you can take a similar vow to bless the heart of the Lord in 2023. So just real quickly, point number one, It doesn't always have to be food that you fast. Take the principle, deprivation of a pleasure. Just take that principle and work with that. Find something that you love. I would advise find something that you love that takes up a lot of your time. You know, maybe that's enjoying entertainment or scrubbing through social media or time that you spend on a cherished hobby. Take those things and just tell the Lord, Lord, I'm going to give up these pleasures for a while, maybe even guilty pleasures. I'm going to give up the excessive things in my life, maybe even things that you've directly given me as blessings, and I'm going to sacrifice those for a while so that I can make extra time to focus on you and honor you, the giver of all those good things in my life. Your nearness to God and my nearness to God is exactly what we've made it to be. No one in this room can say, I'm not as close to the Lord as I want to be, but it's not my fault. I've tried, and he just has not obliged. Here's what you really mean when you say that. Look, last November, I gave it a shot for about 10 minutes. Didn't work, so I gave up. No one can ever say, I wanted to be closer to the Lord. I wanted to dig in deeper. I wanted to grow more in him, but he just didn't come through on his end. No, God has made that unequivocal promise to each and every one of us. Book of James, if we draw near to him, equally so, he will draw near to us. Essentially what the Lord does is he sees how near to him you really want to be, and then he's the one that makes it all possible anyway. He's never going to turn that kind of request down. He's always going to see that heart, and he's always going to honor that heart. But point number two, don't keep your love and devotion for the Lord a secret. I think right there is a really good New Year's resolution. Lord, this year, I'm not going to do my works for you to be seen by people so that I can be applauded by them. I'm not trying to impress people, but Lord, I'm not going to keep my love for you and my devotion for you a secret anymore. So 2023 is going to be my year to begin to share with others, just to make sure that others see, just as they made sure that this Nazirite vow was seen by all. I'm going to make sure that everyone sees, Lord, that I love you and that my life is devoted to you. Doesn't need to be letting your hair grow out. Although if you want to do that, go for it. No one will make fun of you in Anchored Fellowship, probably. Doesn't have to be letting your hair grow out. But again, grab that principle. Grab that principle and run with it. What can I do, Lord, to make you more known in my life? And point number three, it's just further dedication to touching things, or I should say, from avoiding touching things that defile. That is a very easy principle to take and transplant from the Old Testament to the New Testament. If we were to carry out a New Testament version of that, here's what it would look like. A vow to abstain from watching anything, hearing anything, or doing anything that would spiritually defile us. So maybe that means you start checking TV ratings a little bit better. Maybe that means you don't watch filth. I mean, well, honestly, why do we want to reward Hollywood by giving them our money for producing vile filth for us anyway? Why do we want to do that? Maybe it means paying more attention to the things that we watch and whether or not those things are defiling us or benefiting us spiritually. Maybe it means we take the K-Love monthly challenge and we don't listen to any music for a month. Anything but Christian music for a month. That's all I do anyway, but you know, for you, maybe that's a recommendation you need. Maybe there's music that you're listening to that's feeding your soul with the wrong things. It's feeding your soul with lusts and covetousness and all of the kind of things that the popular music genres are producing these days. All right, let's finish this study out. I would have liked to read down through verses 22 through 27 and explain it a little bit. Let me just point out two things real quick, and then we're going to read through this as our closing prayer, okay? Because this is it. This is the closer. This is the priestly blessing that was to be said over the nation every single day. I love that the Lord didn't want to send the nation away with scoldings and warnings about how holy he is and how severe he takes out his wrath on those that cross him. The Lord wanted every time that the nation left the priest to be left with a positive note about the Lord and his blessing. In other words, priests, when you send the people away, I want these thoughts about me to be on their minds. Look real quickly at verse 24. It's a prayer that the Lord would bless them and keep them. Those two have to be together. It's not good enough for the Lord to bless you if the Lord doesn't keep you. If the Lord blesses you for 3 years, but then stops keeping a hold of your life and lets go of you, and you begin to wander outside of the kingdom and eventually completely abandon the kingdom, those blessings weren't very good at all. So it's blessing us and keeping us. Look at verse 26. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you. What does that mean? This is what happens when you walk into a room and someone's happy to see you, and they've got their head down or they're looking elsewhere, and you walk in the room and they turn and they look up. They look directly at you. They give you their attention and they give you a smile, a look of pleasure. That's what this verse is talking about. So let's read through this and close out with this as our prayer. Everyone got it? As soon as we're done here, as soon as we read this last verse, you're free to go. This is our prayer. Verse 22. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to Aaron and his sons, saying, thus shall you bless the people of Israel. You shall say to them, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. So shall they put my name upon the people of Israel, and I will bless them." God bless you, Anchored, and good night.